You're listening to the Zinquista Show, episode 11. Hey, what's up with all the Canadians on the Zinquista Show, eh? See what I did there? Welcome to the Zinquista Show, the show for online course creators who care about building actionable, meaningful, and profitable online courses. If you're a solo entrepreneur, tech geek, or creative, the Zinquista Show is the place to get expert advice for creating your online course, overcoming overwhelm, and growing a balanced business. To get the full experience, sign up at zencourses.co, where you'll get access to free lessons, resources, and more. Again, that's zencourses.co. Hey, thanks for tuning in to episode 11 of the Zinquista Show. Listen, I am super excited to share this episode with you. I think it's one of the best ones that I have done on the show. In this episode, I'm interviewing Sarah Selecki from sarahselecki.com about her course, Story is a State of Mind. And this episode is super special because she breaks down how to teach a creative process, and more importantly, how to teach a course that is about transformation rather than creating a set of tasks for people to work through. So it's a little bit different. And Sarah and I get to talking about her course development process. We talk about writing and how to break through some of the struggles, teach people to break through some of the struggles of writing. And then I share a little bit about my personal writing journey. So enjoy the episode, and I'll see you in the outro. What's up, everyone? Thanks for tuning in to the Zinquista Show. Today, I am super excited to chat with Sarah Selecki. You might know Sarah from her site, sarahselecki.com, or her popular writing course, Story is a State of Mind, where she helps writers develop good habits and learn techniques to make their writing practice come alive. Sarah, welcome to the Zinquista Show.
Thank you, Janelle. I'm really happy to be here.
I am happy to chat with you. So is there anything you want to add to that intro? Can you tell us a bit more about yourself and the work you do?
Well, I'm an author, and I'm working on a novel right now, and that's taking up a big part of my psychic space. So while I'm teaching writers how to write, I'm also, you know, practicing what I teach and dividing my time up for that quiet creative time as well. So
yeah,
that's the... You know, that's the tension that all writers live, and I'm no different.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. So I read online, did a little research, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of information about where you live. I read that you live in Toronto, you are in Victoria, BC, then you're in the countryside of Ontario. So where in the world, literally, where in the world are you?
Right now, I'm speaking to you from Picton, Ontario. Main street of this cute little town, just about 2 or 3 hours east of Toronto. We've recently left the city, sold our home, and we are renovating a barn and moving into a barn probably by the winter, I hope.
How fun.
Yeah.
How fun. Okay. So let's have some fun and help people get to know you a little bit. I've got five quick questions for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Early bird or night owl?
Early bird, definitely. Okay. I lose my words at around 9 p.m. A terrible dinner guest if it's a late dinner. I can't hold a conversation. Early bird.
Okay. What's your favorite animal?
Tigers. Love them.
Okay.
All cats, but tigers especially.
Okay. And if you weren't a writer, what would you be?
I'd probably be a painter.
Okay.
Still an artist. I've thought about that. Yeah, still an artist. I've thought about giving up writing many times over my life. Just I can't do it. And it's always gone to art.
Huh. Okay. So it would be cliche, since you are an author, it would be cliche to ask you what your favorite book is. So what is your favorite word and what does it mean?
This is such a great question. My favorite word changes all the time. I'm absolutely delighted. If you could see my face right now, I'm just like, it's the best question ever. One of my favorite words, and one that I actually have up on my bulletin board that I have had up for the past year because it just brings me so much delight, is sprezzatura. It's an Italian word, and it means something like just doing all a very complicated task, but looking like it's just like magic and enchantedly easy. Just like with sprezzatura, you just pull it together.
Sprezzatura. I love it. I love that you went international. Love that. Okay. So, and last question, what is the hardest part about being a writer?
The hardest part for me is living with a foot in two worlds at the same time while still being present in my real world and being present in the fictional world. Coming in and out, the travel between the two states of mind is the most difficult for me.
Gotcha. Hence, story is a state of mind.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Those were great answers. So let's get into your entrepreneurial journey. So how did you come to be an entrepreneur? What was the journey like?
You know, I like started a private eye business when I was in second grade. I've always been out there.
Like, one ever just says that. Okay, so you started a private eye business. Tell us more.
I just always was one to take matters into my own hands and figure out what was needed and hang a sign on the door and open myself up for business. It just was something I've always done. And, you know, I read a lot of Nancy Drew. That's probably where that came from when I was little. But as I grew up and held jobs and kept applying for landing jobs and then realizing I didn't like working for other people, you know, from a very young age. I liked the money, but I didn't really like working for other people. It was always difficult. So I think I've been an entrepreneur for a long time, but I've only recently, accepted the title, the word itself. But I've always put myself out there in that way since I was really young. I really started, teaching creative writing privately. In about the year 2000, I think. That's when I started on this trajectory.
Okay. So if I know I read on your site that you started teaching in person. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. In your living room? I put up a poster at the local laundromat, you know, where you cut the little phone numbers at the bottom so people could tear off the – and that's how I started. And, you know, my first – class was a handful of people who came to my apartment, and I charged like $30 for a 5-week course or something like that, and just learned with the help of a friend who was an actual paid honest to goodness teacher how to put a lesson plan together and how to guide people from the beginning, middle, and end of a class and a program. So I started that on a really small scale and didn't bring it online until I had done that for about a decade, actually.
So why, I just have to, you know, ask the question, if you're small in, you know, your living room writing class was going so well, what was your motivation for going online?
Well, I can reach more people. So the people who could come to my class, this is when I was living in Victoria, BC, and then later I did move to Toronto and opened up my class to people who lived in Toronto, and sometimes actually people drove a couple hours to get there. In one case, I had someone fly in from Newfoundland and stay in Toronto for 6 weeks to work with me. So I was reaching more and more people. The network, our networks started to expand in a very real way, I think around the time of Facebook, probably around that time, Facebook, and when social media started happening, our networks actually started changing. Like the actual, you know, I've always been sharing my work through word of mouth, and my courses were always well shared through word of mouth, but word of mouth was passing borders and became, you know, certainly national and then international. And I wanted to go online so that I could teach these incredible people who I was connecting with. I mean, I was answering a need. And I was a little behind actually at the time. I think I was a little bit behind. Like people had been asking for me to do that. for a couple of years before I got the gumption together to figure out how to do it myself.
Gumption, one of my favorite words. Okay. if anyone listening can't tell, I'm a word geek as well. So I love that you're throwing all these great words out. So can you give us an overview of your two online courses?
Sure. There's Stories of State of Mind. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the foundation course. It's a 7-lesson course that is completely downloadable. What I did was I found a way or ways to transfer and, you know, holographically represent. That was always that's what I wanted. I just wanted a holograph. I wanted to make my living room school available in anybody else's living room. So it really came from the inside out. I've used a combination of video and audio and some transcriptions, readings, and a whole slew of exercises that I've been working with real people for about 10 years to put that together in that way. So it's very, very well practiced. The ARC, I trust very, very well. I know that it works for most people who come to me. Like, most people who find me are the kind of writers who respond very well to this lesson plan. And I have packaged it in a way that makes it really easy for anybody to work with it, even if they're offline, which was always the point for me. And I want people to be able to limit their computer time and their screen time in order to focus their creative work. So it was very important to me that this all be downloadable and usable if you go offline. So you can download the whole program. You can download it to your laptop. You can print all the printed matter out. I encourage people to put it all in a binder, print it out, and then you can go away somewhere and just use it without having to be connected to the internet. Or you can also connect to the internet and be a part of the online community. There's a private Facebook group where you can do the lessons with a buddy or do the lessons with a group of people or even meet people in real time. So it really is an ecosystem that way. The second course that I have is based on Story State of Mind. It really is an extension of Stories to State of Mind. And to shorten it, I called it the Story Intensive, but it really is the Story is a State of Mind Intensive. Mm-hmm. And that program uses an online classroom to connect people in real time over a set semester. So it's not self-paced any longer. Students are put in a class with 6 to 8 other students and a TA who's function is there to guide you through each of the lessons if you have any questions or need any support, also to read your assignments. So you have the accountability of the other classmates and your TA who is in touch with me for every lesson as well. So we're sort of in a greater contact. It just really helps people who aren't self-motivated in a creative place necessarily to finish it, to complete it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's the same class. One just has a more online community and the other one's self-paced.
Got you. Okay. So, and just to go back to something that you said that it's really Story is a State of Mind Intensive. How did that evolution happen? Did you try to fit that structure into the original Story is a State of Mind and see that it wasn't working? Like, how did you decide, let me create something separate?
Because I was just paying attention to how people were using Story is a State of Mind. So when I was teaching, here's more of the evolution. I'll slow it down piece by piece a bit more because that helps answer this question. I was teaching in person in my living room. Then I began teaching online more in the way that the Story Intensive now is taught online. I had a class of 6 to 8 students who met online and we met in real time. The demand for that was getting too high. I was opening up to the international community and more people wanted to study with me than I could teach, certainly if I was going to continue writing books myself. So that's when I thought, I need a holograph. Like, I want to just clone, I want to do this, but I want people to be able to do it. So that's why I started Story is a State of Mind. It was out of necessity to reach the people who wanted to learn what I was teaching. Then I saw that without only a small fraction of people are actually committed, and not that they're committed, people are committed, but it's very, very hard. Resistance for a creative for a creative course, I mean, a course that's not promising you money or success or publication or like a step-by-step, you'll finish a novel in these 7 steps. That's not the kind of course that this is. This is much more about changing your relationship to your mind and rewiring around your writing process so that you learn to love it and learn to love it for what it is, not for what it's going to get you. And that's a real psychic shift, and it's very difficult. Resistance comes up for all artists. And if you're struggling with resistance, a self-paced program is really difficult. It's a real challenge. You need to set a lot in place in order to let yourself follow through. And it was really hard for me to see these talented writers, like really wonderful, talented writers, faltering halfway through the course because their resistance and real life got the better of them, and they just weren't able to do it without the guidance of a real person bringing them through it. Because some people are, but it's a small fraction of people who are able to do that. So I went back to the drawing board and was like, "What's missing?" Like, it was really working when I was teaching it. I can't go back to teaching it because I have hundreds of students now, and I was having a hard time managing it when I had 50 students. So what I did was look back at those initial students who I had been mentoring since the beginning, my graduates, the people my mentees, who love the program because they were working with it either online with me or sometimes back in my own living room, a lot of them. And I asked them if they would be willing to evolve with me in teaching and take their writing to the next level by learning how to teach it and how to guide and mentor new writers who are new to the Stories of State of Mind process. So I found, 10 to 12, every year, it fluctuates a little bit, but I have about 10 to 13 TAs who are my mentees, who now I have fixed at the head of each of those classrooms, and they run the course the way I used to run it when I was teaching online, when I had my like 30 to 50 students through the year.
Yeah.
So it really is, it really did evolve organically and slowly. And there was, I just was attending to what my people really needed and what I really needed. And also thinking about my mentees and what would really help them next with their writing, because something different happens when you teach. Something different can happen to your process. If you're teaching in the right way, it really teaches you. So I wanted to open that up to my students, to some of my older students. I don't mean older in age. I mean older in the time that they've been working with me, and open that evolution up to them as well. And since I already have this framework, it became a really easy new next step. And that's been this whole other benefit to the story intensive that I didn't even know, when I started all of this. It was just like, how do I get it? I never thought, oh, it would be incredible to watch my TAs teach. But that's been really marvelous as well.
So I'm going to ask you about your TAs, but before I do that, sidebar moment, official sidebar moment. How the heck did you get Margaret Atwood to be one of your guest lecturers? She's one of my favorite writers. How did you pull that off?
She's amazing. I met her at a festival. I was just putting myself in the realm of writing festivals again after taking, about a year off and just living with my head inside this screen when I was developing the online program. I came up for air after it launched and thought, okay, I gotta be around writers again. Like I have to go. So I went to a conference and I met her there, and she had heard of my program. She'd heard about my program through somebody else, another writer, told her about Story State of Mind. This was right after it launched. This was just a few months after it first launched in 2011. And Margaret had a lot of questions for me about what I was doing, because so many writers, I mean, she is a successful writer, both in her career, obviously with publication and financially so, certainly in, in Canada. She's a very successful writer, and her colleagues and friends are even other successfully published authors are still struggling financially, because writing literature, certainly in Canada, isn't a big money venture. It's not like writing a cookbook or writing, you know, a self-help novel and then getting a platform that you can speak and go on speaking tours. Readings and literature, like literary writers, often need a second job, and more often than not, that falls to teaching. I mean, that's all these MFA programs, in part, are sustaining themselves because they are creating an economy for teachers to be teaching and be getting paid. And it's like, you know, the economy needs to feed itself through teaching most often. So the problem then becomes, you know, the same problem I had, which is when you're teaching enough to support yourself financially, when do you find time to write? And if you are teaching so much that you are supporting yourself financially, when does it, that you run the risk, writers run the risk of, I'm trying to say this delicately, so because I love my industry and I love my programs and I love the programs that I was taught, the teachers I was taught by, but there is a real struggle between sharing your creative juice and energy with students instead of your own work. So all back to Margaret Atwood, she was very curious about what I was doing because in some way what I was doing had seemed to, the possibility was there that I had cracked some kind of code, as she said, and she wanted to know what I was doing. And we started our relationship that way. Just I shared with her what I was innovating around, and she was really interested and supportive of it. She's an entrepreneur herself, and she offered to help me out however she could. So I asked her if she would give a masterclass and help out my students. And at the same time, then I could have her as one of my guest faculty, in a way that was really useful and fun and exciting. And yeah, I'm very grateful to her. She's a very generous person.
Wonderful. Okay. So you touched on a lot of things in that I want to come back to. But first, let's dig into Stories of State of Mind. So you gave us an overview of the course. Can we get more of a peek into the structure? How many lessons are there? What does it look like when you log into the course?
Sure. Well, it's, I should also say that this is, as I describe it now, I'm right at the start of a revamp. We're going to be doing Stories of State of Mind 3.0 next year, so it will look slightly different. But okay. I'd like to keep the functionality that we adore, that works so much for us. I'd like to keep in the new model. So I'll try to keep it to that when I discuss it. So right now, students log into the classroom, which is a WordPress site, so it looks like a website, and the classroom has lots and lots of white space, and everything's lined up by color. There are 7 lessons, and each lesson is a different color, so you can keep track of it really easily that way. There are different components to each class. Many of them have a video pep talk from me. They all have readings that you can download, or you can open up and read directly on the screen if you're connected to the internet. Each of the readings are associated with a lecture by me, and that's an audio lecture, not a video, an audio lecture where I discuss the reading and what craft-based lessons I want to teach and show for each of the lessons and each of the readings. The lessons are divided by theme, starting with free writing, going to what starts a story, moving through character, dialogue, plot, point of view, and then coming to influence at the end. The arc is deceptively linear. it helps. I've seen that it really helps students to have a linear progression, so they feel like people really love. And I think we're hardwired in some way to feel like we're collecting some points and steps and moving towards something. The truth is, this could be a circle. This could be a net. This could be some, there are many other geometries that these lessons could fit into. But the way that I've organized them this way is a result of 10 years of practicing, mixing it up in different ways. This really is the best for most people. By the end of the 7 lessons, after you've gone through each of the exercises, their practice exercises and longer assignments that are a little bit more robust that are associated with each lesson. And after you go through all of them, astute students will see that they loop back on each other. I mean, we're starting with free writing, but we always loop back to free writing. We go through character and then we come back to character. Like there really is a looping back and an ebb and a flow to the practice exercises and assignments. Certainly also with the readings, like you'll be picking up things about character. And then as you continue reading, you'll understand more about plot, but then you'll loop back to character and see how character feeds plot and how point of view organizes story, really, and how free writing connects everything. So there is this really nice sort of wholeness to it. By the time you move through and get to the end of the program, if you just follow the assignment, if you just simply do what the assignments tell you to do, you will have a finished, completed draft of a short story by the end of 7 lessons.
Okay. And who is your ideal learner for Story as a State of Mind?
Someone who already knows that she is a writer or he is a writer. It doesn't have to be someone who has a story to tell and knows that they have a story to tell. You don't have to have a story to tell to benefit from this course, but you do have to have a love of writing, like a deep love of writing and languages and sentences, and be open to changing the way you think about your own writing life. So my ideal student is someone who is willing to be curious, willing to be open, willing to suspend disbelief in order to try some new ways of practicing, and also someone who's not afraid to be present and not afraid to be with what is. So while there's a certain amount of letting go that's necessary to finish these lessons, there's also a great deal of being here at the same time, which sounds like a bit of a paradox, but you need both in order to really go deep in your writing or in any creative practice, I would venture to add. So my ideal student is someone who knows that they love writing. There's no question there that they love it, because the love really is the foundation, and are willing to try anything, even if it feels irrational or possibly inefficient to the way they usually do things, in order to reconnect with their love of writing again.
Right. Now, I know that you said the course is self-paced, so I'm sure the enrollment, you know, ebbs and flows. But how many students do you have enrolled?
You know, I have about, I know that you were going to ask this question, so I looked into it. I have over 500 students in Stories of State of Mind, enrolled in Story State of Mind right now. Currently, because the Story Intensive is on from September to December, so it's on right now. In there, I have 85 students who are taking it at the same time.
Gotcha.
So maybe it actually, I don't know if my 500 count actually counts them. I think it might not. So I might have closer to 600 students who are enrolled in the program. And enrollment does go up when Story Intensive time, enrollment time is up, which is in the summertime. But, you know, I looked back over the years, at my numbers, and enrollment has been steady since I opened the doors. You know, it started at about 8 per month, and now it's gone up to about 10 to 15 per month. So over the years that I've been open, which is since 2011, we've had a steady, at least an average of about 10 students enrolling per month.
Cool.
Which is not crazy, but it feels really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been steady growth, which is what's so important. That's how you have a sustainable business.
Yeah.
So when we chatted over email, you made the comment and you alluded to it earlier and you said, oh, I could have used so much help when I was starting out. So let's go back. Let's time travel back to that moment when you decided, okay, people are asking for me to teach online. What were your biggest challenges when you started?
Oh my gosh. What wasn't a challenge? I didn't know how to do anything. What I would have done is just like call you. Like, where do I start? Big challenges. I didn't know how to code. I didn't know how to code. Didn't know WordPress. Didn't know how to edit video. Didn't know how to transcribe my audio. Didn't really know how to do audio, although I was using GarageBand on my Mac, and that's we did some of that. I didn't have a good camera, so I rented a good camera that had a really great lens. Didn't know how to use it. The videos are a little funny because it was the first time we've ever used that camera, and the focus is really touchy. It's all in focus, but just sometimes it's like extreme close-ups, if you know what I mean. What wasn't a challenge was what I was teaching. I knew what I wanted to teach. I knew how I wanted to teach it. I knew my lesson plan inside out, and I knew who my students were, and I knew where they would falter, and I knew where their strengths would soar. I knew all of that, and thank goodness for that, because all the problems really were technical and very, very solvable. I just had to work and call people and get assistance really on all the tech stuff.
Yeah, when you were going through that list, I was thinking that is actually such a good thing that because you had the content, you knew your material.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The technical stuff you can figure out. It may be frustrating, and it is frustrating.
Yep.
It can be really frustrating.
Yeah, it can be frustrating. It was a lot of moving pieces and getting it all together on one place. I mean, there weren't at the time there weren't so many all in one. Class, like online classroom sites, like teaching places where you could do all of this. It was very nuts and bolts, very granular. Like we had to put things together and code it from scratch. And, you know, there was one thing that we did. I mean, now there's Typeforms, which is this awesome, awesome service that creates surveys, but not just for surveys, but quizzes and online, you know, you could do job interviews. It just collects information from people, but in a sophisticated way. Gosh, I wish that was around then. What we had to do, because one of the things that I do in person that was the most difficult to transfer to an online self-paced, the most difficult thing to transfer to a self-paced course was giving prescriptions, what I call prescriptions, to my authors based on what they're writing and what they're reading and what their joys and strengths and you know, where they can strengthen themselves more, where all of that is, just tell them what to read, giving them personalized reading subscription or prescriptions, not subscriptions. And usually I can do that by paying attention to my students in class because I'm reading them. I'm hearing what they're working on. I see them. We have conversations. I know what they're reading. So I have that back and forth. I needed to transfer that somehow online to someone I wasn't meeting in person. And what I did was develop, a quiz, a pretty long, fairly complicated quiz, asking a whole slew of questions about what they're writing and what their reading preferences and styles are. Kind of like a personality quiz, I guess, like a Myers-Briggs sort of thing, except for writing. And then I had to figure out how to put that quiz online. And we got someone to code it. It's still there, and it's like. Kind of grainy essence, but it does the trick. It works. It does the trick. Like the technology worked. It does the trick. It works. People understand it. And they do receive their recommended reading list as a result of that quiz. But had Typeform been around, gosh, it would be just so slick and pretty and easy, you know? So,
yeah, definitely. Well, it's got to give you something to work and look forward to. So
absolutely.
Let's talk about, because for anyone who's in the situation where maybe they are doing what you were doing, and that is having in-person teaching sessions, and they're wanting to take their teaching online, what did you learn? And what I mean is when you transitioned from in-person to online, what did you learn about how to adjust the material? And you touched on it a moment ago, but what were kind of the big lessons or maybe some of the things where you made mistakes or you didn't nail it? Mm-hmm. What was that process of transitioning that material for an online environment?
That's a great question. And I'm really happy to have the opportunity to answer it. If you're working with people in person, and you're teaching the same course over and over and developing it, you know, tweaking it, it's just sort of natural, I think, that good teachers tweak their materials as the years go on as they learn. When you're doing that, you get a sense, or I got a sense, I'll speak for myself, I get a sense of where students struggled and how important that struggle is for their learning. So my role as a teacher is not to take away their struggle or make it easier for them. It's to let them know that they're struggling in the right way, at the right time, at the right place, and to hold the space for them in that struggle so they can actually grow. And I was able to do that more easily in person because I was just like, at the moment, I could respond to my students at the moment where they were doing that. So when I moved to online, what was really important for me to do was look at all of the years that I'd been teaching in person and in my wiki space, in my online teaching space when I was still teaching in person, and just getting a big overview, looking back and seeing where did people struggle the most, and then try to find a way to preemptively meet that struggle with a pep talk or a way that I wrote the lesson or presented the lesson or something, because I know that if they're on their own, they're probably going to struggle around here. And that might be a place that they let go if they don't have someone letting them know that it's okay to be struggling there. So not doing it for them, not taking out a lesson away, because the problem, getting through the struggle is how you learn. This is online learning. This is like, you've got to get yourself through the struggle. It's just, you can talk yourself out of that if you don't have someone meeting you when and where you need it. So I found ways to give my students pep talks when I felt that they would need those pep talks, in the form of autoresponders that are set, you know, 3 months after purchase, or a lesson specific pep talk through video or audio that you can add. That's just a little bit of extra material so people can hear it if they're feeling a little bit like, ugh, I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't for me. This is too hard. Obviously it's not for me. Finding ways in your online course to meet that need is really, really, really good for your students.
So I'm sitting here, I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, so just full disclosure, I studied creative writing when I was in college. So I am a writer. I haven't written regularly. And so, but I know the struggles of being a writer. I guess my question is, are you teaching writing or are you teaching something different? Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. Janelle, I'm teaching both. I mean, that's why I became a teacher, because I didn't want to be learning the something else in a way that wasn't connected to my own writing. And when I studied writing and got my MFA, I wasn't learning enough of the something else to put it with my writing. And I wanted both, because it is a big journey. I mean, that struggle is finding surrender on the page requires a certain amount of surrender of the person. And that's like a big life lesson that, you know, learning about how to structure your dialogue won't teach you necessarily. Yeah. But you can't write amazing literature if you don't know how to write dialogue well. You know, you need both.
And it's so, you know, for me, it's such a scary process. And I wonder, how have you been able to successfully guide people through the fear?
Well, I lead people back to their love of writing first. Because if you feel the love, like if you think about it as a relationship, which is why I always think about it as a relationship. I mean, going out with someone, getting married, like committing to a relationship
yeah.
is terrifying because you have no, there's no guarantees, but the love brings you there. So if you love writing, it's worth being scared.
Yeah.
So the love is really, really important. Like strengthening that connection, whether you write something good or bad, whether it ever gets published or not, whether people criticize it or adore it, it doesn't matter because it's yours and you love it. That's the diamond inside. Then you can learn all that other stuff, but it's just like cool stuff you get to do with your writing. You know, you get to play with character. You get to explore what kinds of dialogue, like do you use quotation marks or not use quotation marks? What does that do to my craft? What if I change this point of view to first person? Well, if I change it to third person, what does that do to it? All of that stuff is just fun if you love writing and you're strong in your love, you know? Mm. So that's, yeah. I think, how I teach it. I mean, that's what I try to do. And that's what I try to teach is that the love comes first and there's a lot of repair that, you know, that right. Like recovering writing students, need to go through sometimes depending on one's experience in a creative writing class. Sometimes there's a lot of repair, like a lot of damage was done in those programs to some writers. Mm-hmm. Not all writers. I had a really great experience in mine, but I do know that many students come to me having been quite hurt. And that hurt, I mean, it breaks my heart because it's like it hurts the thing that should never, ever have been transgressed, which is somebody's connection to their creativity. I mean, that's just, you don't go there.
Gotcha. Yeah, totally agree. Okay. Something you said earlier was your course, it's not, so we're not teaching anyone 7 steps to write a book or, you know, however absurd that sounds, but it is, there's not this, you know, and it's not about a certain amount of money, this certain tangible outcome. Mm-hmm. So has that been challenging?
Well, you know, yeah, it would be quite challenging. So I made a tangible outcome and I did this through teaching in person as well. The tangible outcome is by the end of those 7 weeks, if you are here with me doing it, you will have the first draft of a short story. You'll have something that you didn't have when you came in. So there is something tangible there. The way you get there is circuitous.
Right.
Like the way you get to that draft might not be the way you're used to completing things in your life in other parts of your life, but you'll get there. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get to teach the lessons of writing and the habits.
That's right.
Through that journey. Okay.
That's right.
So let's switch gears and talk about writing for an online course or instructional writing. Mm-hmm. How has that been different for you to write for teaching?
You know, it's all like letter writing to me. It's all, and I actually think a lot of what I wrote in this In Story State of Mind, which when you print it off, it is kind of a book on writing, just like a workbook, you know, there are exercises, but it is really a book on writing. Much of the material in that book that I wrote about writing, the instructional stuff, was directly lifted from actual letters that I've written to my students. So I didn't set out to teach instructional writing. I have certain students in mind who I was addressing quite literally while writing a lot of that copy and a lot of those chapters.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. So, you know, we've all taken courses that have been less than exciting. I'll put it that way. Is that a fault of poor writing? How do we write to keep people engaged in the course?
Maybe it is a fault of poor writing. I think probably it's the same that I would say about writing fiction, which is if you're feeling disconnected, then you're not going to be connecting to your reader.
Yeah.
So whether that's instructional, nonfiction, fiction, poetry, whatever it is that you're writing, if you're not feeling connected to something that's beyond language while you're using language, then all you've got are words. And, you know, we love words. I'm with you. I also love words. I'm a word. I love words. We love words. Not saying we don't love words, but the reason we love words is because of the river that's running underneath them, right? Like what they do, what they point to, the emotional access they can give us, what they spark. That's why we love words. Words themselves are just marks on a page. So if you're writing a course and you're not feeling connected to the material and the student, if you're writing it in order to get it done, then that's that energy that you write with is what ripples out. Like that's what, so I think if we're reading something that feels dry and boring, it's because the person writing it wasn't really feeling alive and connected while writing it.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, Sarah, writers need time to be silent, to go within, to take space. So how do you, and you talked about this a little bit, but how do you balance your online business and courses with finding time to write and be inspired?
It's like balance is definitely a verb in this situation. and it takes a lot, it takes more courage than I may, because I've spoken about this before, and I do say it's true what I say on my website, on my about page, is that I take time off every year where I go dark, and I go off Instagram and social media every year for a period of time. And that sounds very brave and like black and white, and what I want to say underneath that is it takes a lot of courage, and it's difficult to do every time because the pull to remain in this world is very strong. And it also takes courage to just trust that my writers, my subscribers, my readers, my students will be okay if I'm not there reminding them that I exist for half of the year. As the years go on and I have more practice doing it, it gets a little more, it gets a little easier. I wouldn't say easy. I just get a little bit more comfortable with the feeling of, oh God, I feel this way again. I don't want to go offline because I'm afraid that, you know, that my website will shut down if I'm not there. But it hasn't. In fact, it's become stronger and stronger and stronger. And I think that's a direct result of the time that I take away from it. And I think that my writers, my students and subscribers are really smart, thoughtful, evolved people who understand their own need for white space and would never begrudge me mine. And the other thing is, you know, this is what I teach people to do, to take time off and to go offline and to be quiet and do nothing sometimes. And if I'm not doing that myself, then I can't really be teaching it with integrity. So that's why I do it, because it's intolerable not to. and I do it because it's the right thing for me to do. So I go away, and I go offline. I put an autoresponder on, once the story intensive closes, which is in December, everyone graduates in December, we take a holiday, and then I do a little debrief with all of my TAs in January, and then I go quiet. I still put some newsletters out there sometimes, but it's irregular. You know, it's a little inconsistent. People know that I'm writing, and I come back in the spring, and I start up the year with the Little Bird Writing Contest, and I get people involved that way again. And then everyone, lo and behold, is still there and ready to talk to me. So it works so far.
Beautiful. So we're down to the final three questions. First one, what's next for you? Anything exciting coming up?
Oh my gosh. everything right now is in transition. It's so exciting. I am, you know, it's been 5 years, and it's time for something new. So we are moving. We're moving Stories of State of Mind to a new website. We're opening it up as a proper school, and separating sarahsilecki.com from storiesstateofmind.com. So that's okay. In part because I'm finishing up my novel and I would like it to have a home that's outside of the school. So I'd like to have it a home, give it a home with sarahsilecki.com, give it some breathing space. And the school is so big right now that it's kind of outgrown sarahsilecki.com, frankly. So we're going to give it its own space, its own realm. Story State of Mind, the program will live there. The Story Intensive will live there. Lots of ideas for new courses and guest instructors and live events, retreats and workshops with me in different places. Lots of really great stuff happening with the school. And I'm writing a book. So in a quieter, much more or less glamorous way, that's all new and exciting too. I'm coming to the end of a first draft, and it's all a new journey for me. So that's happening. And we just left the city and moved to the country. So in this new space, which is a large space, we are going to be opening up. We're going to go back to teaching in person sometime. Oh. Going back to open up the Living Room Writing School again in the future here in the country. It's a beautiful, beautiful space to be writing. And I'm really looking forward to opening up small classes again, in a different way, of course, this time. But, you know, circling back, these things work in circles, not lines, I'm beginning to see. So, yeah, lots of new stuff coming in the next
couple
years.
Lots of exciting stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've already mentioned your website. Where is that the best place for people to find out more about you?
Definitely. Yeah. SarahSilecki.com is definitely the best spot for now.
Okay. Last question, Sarah. What's your why? Why do you get up and do this work every day?
My why is all about the magic that happens when I feel connected to my writing. It really is when I can have my writing connected and intertwined with the magic of life, like the magic that is everywhere. I feel like that's kind of the point to everything. So my why is like, because magic happens. That's why.
I love it. Thank you so much, Sarah. This has been great to chat with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey there. Man, that was such a fun interview with Sarah. To find out more about Sarah and her courses, head over to her site, sarahsilecki.com. That is Sarah Silecki, SELECKY.com. Okay, looking for the show notes? Well, head over to zencourses.co/011 and you'll find all the links and highlights from episode 11. Again, that's zencourses.co/011. All right. So you all are amazing. The online course plan template has been blowing up. Have you got your free copy? Listen, I know how hard it can be to figure out where to start building your course. To help you get started on the right foot, I've put together a free one-page online course plan template just for you. So in only one page, you will answer some critical questions and create a simple course plan so you can get busy building and stop putting off your dream course. How do you get this template, you might ask? Well, I made it super easy. Just head over to zencourses.co, that's ZENCOURSES.CO, and click Get Your Free Course Planner. How can it get any easier than that? All right. I'm Janelle Allen, and this has been the Zen Courses Show. As always, thank you, and 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 you, for listening.